And this show that I'm going to do today is one that I've been thinking of that I wanted to do on Christmas. It's a very human story. And basically it's this. As an activist, presidential advisor, and co-founder of the Enough Project and the author of 10 books on Africa, including his most recent The Enough Moment, John Prendergast is known as a go-to man on human rights. Whether he's traveling to Africa with George Clooney or meeting President Obama about Sudan or writing books with Don Cheadle, John is passionate about ending genocide and raising awareness about human rights issues in Africa. But the not-so-public face of John Prendergast is the life he's led as a big brother to Michael Maddox. As an emotionally wounded, his own description, 20-year-old, John made the life-changing decision to form a big brother-little brother relationship with then 7-year-old Michael, who was living out of plastic bags and roaming from one homeless shelter to the next with his mother and siblings. And this year, in a book that they wrote together, Unlikely Brothers, Our Story of Adventure, Loss, and Redemption, John and Michael share their experiences over the past 25 years as their two lives intertwine. Now, as John became more and more involved with Africa, he became less and less involved with Michael, who in turn dropped out of school, dropped into drug dealing, and as the years went by, the two slowly disconnected. But they reconnected at a critical moment for both of them, and this book tells the story of all of that. John Prendergast is the co-founder of the Enough Project, an initiative to end genocide and crimes against humanity affiliated with the Center for American Progress. He's worked for the Clinton White House, the State Department, two members of Congress, the National Intelligence Council, UNICEF, Human Rights Watch, International Crisis Group, U.S. Institute of Peace. He is the author or co-author of 10 books. His previous two books were co-authored with John Cheadle, Not on Our Watch, and The Enough Moment, Fighting to End Africa's Worst Human Rights Crimes. John is a board member and serves as strategic advisor to Not on Our Watch, the organization founded by George Clooney, Matt Damon, Don Cheadle, and Brad Pitt. He's been a youth counselor, a basketball coach, and a big brother for more than 25 years. Michael Maddox lived in homeless shelters as a child and began dealing drugs as a teenager. He is now a husband, a father of 5 boys. I know that one of his boys' birthday is today, and that he and his wife have another child on the way, and he's hoping for a little girl. He works 2 jobs at once in order to support his family, and he helps coach his sons and their family. Welcome, Michael.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. And John.
Thank you so much for having us, Dave.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Now, I like listeners to get to know the people behind the work and the ideas, often the books and the projects and so on that we talk about on the show. Given the topic of your book, that's not going to be a problem. So sort of in the other way, before we jump into your personal lives alone and together, let me ask each of you to briefly talk about your path to the work you do in the world, and then we'll go in and we'll deal with all the personal stuff. So, John, your path to what you're doing today.
Well, I am now, you know, for the last 28 years, I guess, have been working in human rights and promoting peace in Africa. But, of course, no one is a teenager thinking they're going to do that for a career. So I basically, at the age of, I think, 21, was watching late-night TV and too lazy to get up to turn the channel. This is before remote controls existed. And all of a sudden, pictures of the famine in Ethiopia came on the screen, and this is the famine, the great famine in 83 and 84 and 85 that ended up spurring the Live Aid and We Are the World, all those kind of things that got everybody interested in Africa for a minute. I was deeply affected by the pictures, the photographs of these people huddled over little fires, no shelter, no food. Obviously, thousands and thousands of kids starving to death, and I just decided I was going to go and try to understand better directly how our world, which back in the U.S. seems, even though it's unfair and inequitable, still plentiful compared to that, and I just want to understand how people could literally starve to death in the 20th century. So that once I went and learned a lot about what was happening there, I decided to make my life's work about reducing the effect of some of the wars and some of the famines on the most vulnerable people in the world.
Okay, and Michael, your path to the work you do today.
Well, what I do today is I basically do motivational speaking.
Ah.
For teenagers and little kids. I'm connected up with this club. Well, it's an organization called Free Minds Book Club. I do a lot of stuff with them, little motivational speaks. They do a lot of stuff with jails. You know, they actually help the kids in jail and help them while they get out of jail. And I go to a lot of functions that they host. Matter of fact, I just took my boys to one last week on Tuesday, and it was wonderful. You know, so basically that's what I do. I'm trying to get the message out about the mentoring thing, and basically tell my life story, try to help others out with their life story. You know, because I've been through so much where basically my life story can help, you know, other people out. You know, they ask me how did I change and a lot of other things. So I sit there and I break it down to them, and it helps. It really
yeah.
helps.
In other words, you're hoping that they learn from your mistakes and your redemption.
Yes, yes. Because right now, you know, as we speak, I'm on the right path with that, you know. So I'm trying to keep it going strong, you know. So my motivational speaks is so wonderful. It's so wonderful. Trust me.
Very, very good. Okay, Michael, I understand that you proposed to John that you two write this book together. Why?
Because, you know, I looked at it, I said, you know, he's doing books with Don Cheadle, you know, you know, this and that. I said, you know what, this is my brother. We need to tell us a story. We got a story to tell, too, you know, a nice, wonderful story to tell, too, that I think people would be real interested in, you know, reading, which they are. You know, it's a real good story about me and him. You learn two lives between two different people, which is life between John and life between me, and it's totally different than how we come together, you know, and that's amazing. You know, you get this one kid that's from this bad drug dealer neighborhood, and you get this other guy that's, you know what I'm saying, White House and, you know, working for these people, and that's my brother, and we still brothers, you know what I'm saying? So it's a wonderful story to tell, you know.
And John, when he approached you, what was your response?
Well, man, I mean, this back in the day, this was inconceivable, you know, that when we first met and all those years that we would have been in a place where we could actually rationally sit down and kind of reflect over these things. But by the time we got to where we are now, it seemed like there's a narrative, there's a thread here of our two lives being able to come together that could be a really compelling story for other people. You know, it's hard sometimes to make the link. It's like you think, well, how's my life going to be something that people will be interested in? How, you know, but then I could see it in relation to Michael, not just on my own. And so when my story of my life is added to Michael's story of his life, and we tell it together, and you know, we're having different perspectives on the same things going chronologically, then it becomes, I think, it became really compelling to me once I started thinking about it. But I have to admit, when he first brought it up, I was like, yeah, right. but then he started, again, you know, he was working on me, you know, and I was like, yeah, maybe that is interesting. Maybe we could do something here. And then the more we thought about it, the more we kind of reflected on the old things that happened and back in the day, it became... like for both of us, I think the burning desire to get this story out there and tell as many people as possible.
The form of the book is interesting in that it's a kind of a duet where you go back and forth, and as you were just saying, John, that way you get each of your different perspective on a different time or a different set of events. Did that just happen right away? Was it just a little bit about the writing process, and then we're going to get into the story.
Well, I think we had to figure out, well, do we write the book as we, you know, we did this, we did that, or do we write the book as I? And if how are we going to do it if we write an I, we have to have our own sections. And I think the we, you know, trying to write a book together literally, you know, there's just too many things that you do on your own that we is impractical. So we decided, okay, we got to do it individually. And so Then we just had to start telling stories. Then we had to go back in our own lives, because, you know, it's one thing to talk about how our lives are together, but unless you know the motivations and the backstory, then nobody cares. So I had to go back in my past and my childhood and understand what my motivations were. Michael had to go back in his early years, earliest memories he could conjure up, and develop the story of how he got to where he was when we first met, and all that kind of introspection. And both of us interviewed a lot of people that were in our past, so we would remember things, because it's not all on total recall. And it was a really interesting process, just going back into time in both of our lives and finding people who remembered things that even we didn't remember about our own lives, and be able to sort of trigger new memories and really plunge the depths of what, you know, makes us who we are.
And Michael, as we said, you proposed this idea once you got into it. What was that process like to you? I'm sure unlike anything you'd ever done before.
Yes, it was. It wasn't unlike anything I'd ever done before, because I'd never written a book or nothing. And it was strange, you know, but long process, but it was also good too, because it helped me out in the long run. You know, I opened up a lot of stuff that I held in the inside, you know what I'm saying, which it came out. So that was a good thing that it did come out.
Yeah, and I believe that happened. I believe that same thing happened for you, John, right?
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. So let's begin the story of Unlikely Brothers, our story of adventure, loss, and redemption. So, Michael, I'm going to ask you first. Let's set the scene. What was your life like at the point that John enters?
Well, before John entered our lives, we was, you know, it was always a little shaky for us. You know what I'm saying? Doing a little homeless shelter thing. You know, carrying around our little trash bags. And, you know, it was just a sad situation.
And how many brothers and sisters are there? And I know that your mom for a while had a partner, and then he suffered an aneurysm and disappears from your life. But when you talk, so we get this picture of the hefty bags and the shelters. How many of you are making this move each day?
It was four brothers and two sisters.
Wow. You know? And your mom.
Four brothers. And my mom. And, it was crazy, because being that small and carrying around, you know, I think about it, carrying around them hefty bags. You know, at that time, we like, you know, we just marching on with my mom. But at that time, you know, you like, wow, we was really carrying around hefty bags, we on the bus. You know, we never know where we're going to sleep that night, you know what I'm saying? My mom, she will always find us a way, you know what I'm saying, somewhere to sleep for that night. I don't care what time we went to bed or whatever. It was, you know, we were small, we knew what was going on, and then we didn't know what was going on. We just know we didn't have no place to stay. You know, it was always these schools, these run-down shelters, run-down motels, you know, the filthiest thing you've ever seen, you know. And I actually ride past them things. They still exist. I get emotional when I ride past them.
I bet. You
know, I really do. I get emotional.
And yet she was able to keep you all in school through all this?
Yes. We all were still in school. We could get to the play, the shelter, at 1 at night.
Oh, my God.
You had to get up in the morning and go to school. So we really didn't get too much homework done. You know, the only work we got done was in school, you know, because we was mainly trying to find out where we were going to sleep that night.
Wow. And this went on for how many years, Michael?
This went on for probably, let's see, wow. Oh, man, probably about 4 years.
Wow. Okay, and John, your life at that time.
Yeah, I was. Let's see. I grew up in all over the Midwest. My dad was a frozen food salesman, so we moved around a lot. And I was going to, and then I went through time for college. I went to five different undergraduate schools. So the time I met by the time I met Michael, I was just a sort of a drifter, and grazing around different issues, trying to find what I wanted to do in this world. And so I came. I visited a friend of mine that day. At that time, I was really still sort of fixed on the idea that I'd be working in on domestic issues, sort of on education and employment issues for young people, how to improve quality of education, especially for people who are, you know, potential dropouts or left out of the system. But I was pretty much somewhat of a loner, kind of moving around a lot, and so I was the least likely candidate, I think, to make a commitment at that point in my life. We actually met.
And you visited a friend at a shelter, and that happened to be the shelter where Michael and his family were at the time?
Yeah, just randomly. One of my buddies, one of the schools I had gone to, one of the colleges I had gone to was Georgetown University, and he also had dropped out, and he went over. He was actually working in a homeless shelter. He was running this social service thing. And so I went over just to visit him, just say hi, and I was hanging around and going to help volunteer a little bit at the shelter with him. And that's when Michael and his little brother James came tearing into the room one afternoon, and I just I was captivated by these young guys. They were so full of life and fun and just kind of interest. And so we just hit it off and decided to head out to the library and work on a little bit of reading goofing around, and just we had a blast, and I just really liked, and I kept coming back and kept seeing the kids, and we just, you know, forged this sort of informal brotherhood with Michael and myself and his little brother James that just emerged on the basis of how much we enjoyed hanging around together.
And again, you're 20 or 21, and he's 7 or 8, and James is a couple of years younger.
Yes.
Yeah. So the one thing I'm going to touch on that's a little bit out of the chronological order here is your both of your father issues, because I think it's important, especially given the role that you took with each other. Both of you, in a way, were traumatized by father issues in different ways. Michael first, you your own father wasn't there, then Willie was. Talk a little bit about just your lack of a father.
Well, you know, Willie was there. My dad wasn't there. And, you know, Willie, he took care of us. You know, that's who I thought was my dad, you know. And right now in the day, I still consider as Willie was being my dad, because he the one that I knew of taking care of us. You know, my father, real father came in life, you know, later on down the line. And we had built a little relationship, but he passed a couple of months ago. But that was like a trauma, you know, like when I first found out who my real dad was.
Mm-hmm.
That was a painful situation, being a little child and thinking one person your dad and finding out somebody else your dad. You know, that was real hurtful.
Yeah.
That was real hurtful. You know, but that's why, like, when I got my sons and I would never leave my sons. I will always be my sons till they get old.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Always.
Yeah. And John, your situation with your father?
My dad, when I was a little guy, was my hero. But when I sort of got up to the age of 7, 8, 9, when you start to form your own opinions about things and you get more potentially confrontational, it did not work out well. We had a tremendously difficult road that was very, very volatile over the years, I did not look at him or speak to him for perhaps 15 years.
And some of those years, John, you were still living in the same house and eating at the same dinner table.
Oh yeah, and we, you know, I would just not, I would act like he wasn't there, and,
wow.
And of course this would drive him crazy. And he was a pretty volatile guy, so So we get pretty hairy in there, and it dominated our family life, this sort of confrontation between my dad and me, and we didn't heal it until way down the road, you know, until I was in my 30s.
Wow. I'm Terrence McNally, and that's the voice of John Prendergast. My other guest is Michael Maddox. John got involved with Big Brothers when he was about 20, and he became a big brother to Michael, who was 7 at the time. And we're talking about their relationship over 25 years and a book that they've written together about it called Unlikely Brothers. So we have this, Michael's living shelter to shelter. John shows up just to visit a friend. They go out to the library, they go out, and then you strike up this thing. Were you, John, already involved with Big Brothers, or did that become a way to formalize what was happening spontaneously?
Yeah, I didn't really know about it, and I was more interested in sort of policies as opposed to individual people. And so when we first started hanging around together, it just dawned on me that this would be the kind of mentoring, sort of tutoring relationship that could really make a difference. And so we never really became a formalized big brother, little brother program relationship. Later, I joined the Big Brothers program and had other young kids where I lived in Philadelphia and then back in D.C., but with Michael and James and his brothers, we were basically family. It transcended any kind of program. We just never enrolled in anything. It was just de facto. We just were brothers to each other.
So, Michael, talk a little bit about, we heard from John the first time that you met and how he was struck by your liveliness and vitality and so on in what looked like difficult circumstances. What was your response to John the first time as your relationship began to blossom? Who was this guy?
Well, you know, in the beginning, he was a strange guy. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, you think about it, like, things just don't happen like that. You know, he was like an angel. You know what I'm saying? In a little kid's life, you know, things like that just don't happen. We see this strange guy. Don't know who this guy is from day one. Just pop up in our lives. You know what I'm saying? We was at the right place at the right time. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, we see him, you know, he spoke to us, you know, we rushed him all. We weren't about getting our little change or whatever. So, you know, he asked his buddy who we were. His buddy told him who we were. And from there, it was like on. You know, he asked us, did we know how to read? We told him a little bit. You know, we know how to read a little bit. And next thing you know, we started going to the library, and he formed a bond with us, you know, that was like, you couldn't break at all, you know, and we started loving this guy so much, you know what I mean? Because he was like, we started having so much fun with him. We started getting something that we never had got before, you know what I'm saying? And that was with this fun guy that's showing us different things, you know, and when he did that, I mean, it was like a done deal. We wanted to see John all the time, you know what I'm saying? And I wish it was more Johns out there, you know, that would do it for the kids now. You know what I'm saying?
Sure,
we need
sure.
More Johns out there, plain and simple. Because, you know, even though I got screwed up late, you know, late on down the line, but at that time, being that little kid, we was having that fun.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have time to get in no trouble. He would always come pick us up, take us through this, do that, basketball, football, fishing, riding around this little station wagon. Well, it ain't no little station wagon, a big station wagon. You know, we just doing fun things. And, I mean, it was amazing to have this strange guy that made this bond with us, and we started loving him. And he was loving us to death, too. He had a lot of fun around with us at the same time, too. So it was good.
And this is, it was mostly you and James?
Yeah, it was mostly me and James at the time. Then, you know, a couple of times my sister came along with us, you know. And then when my little brothers, they got old enough, they started coming along with us too.
Very good. John, I find that a story sometimes is best in moments. So a couple of moments from those years with fairly young John and young Michael and James.
Well, I think the most memorable times were probably one, the fishing, the boating expeditions we take. We get out on the Potomac River and we go out on little boats and we go across to that island out there, forget the name, Roosevelt Island. And to us, it was just sort of like in another planet. You know, go discovering around, go adventuring around on that island, and then come back, back then in that area of D.C. was really undeveloped, so it was really, we're just kind of out there on our own. It was just a lot of fun, and then I guess going on little trips, going to Philly and going to other places, we used to love to just get in that station wagon and go places, and I think we had a lot of fun on the road, you know, just going on road trips and
uh-huh.
discovering stuff and keeping our eyes open and just seeing what the heck's going on in the world. And I think those are the things I remember.
Yeah, I'm as you're saying that, I grew up part of my time in, like, junior high school in Jacksonville, Florida, which is a big city. But going down by the St. John's River, I have a feeling, was like what you guys were doing. It was like
same thing,
another world.
Yep.
What was folks' reaction to this long-haired white guy and these young black kids?
Oh, man, it was crazy, John, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, man. People didn't know what to make out.
My mom had problems with my aunts because they were like, why are you letting this white guy come in here, you know, taking them boys? You don't know what they doing to them boys. You need to stop letting them boy, you know what I'm saying? But
yeah.
It wasn't even like that. It was like, you know, we John did fatherly things with us, man, that, you know, we didn't never have, like I say, parks and reading and basketball and boating and fishing. You know, all them things he taught us, you know what I'm saying? And all them things he actually taught us, I do with my sons, right?
Oh, that's beautiful.
And that's, I'm telling you, I do exactly, maybe fish, basketball, football, you know. I mean, we do all that. And I learned all them things from John.
And, John, you actually moved Michael and his brothers to Philadelphia for a summer. How did that happen?
Well, there was a I got a little wind of the from D.C. Social Services that there was possibility that, given all the instability in the family going from shelter to shelter, that they might consider putting the kids in foster care. I mean, it was never certain that they were going to do it, but it was a worry. And so I went to Michael's mom, Denise, and said, "What if I reduce the pressure here and take the three oldest, Michael and James and Sabrina, to D.C., to Philadelphia, and they can live with me for the summer. I got all my buddies and my family and other people can help out. And then you got the younger kids, and that would make it easier for you to sort of get straight, get on your feet, and find a way to keep the family together." And so it was really just a sort of a self, family preservation approach, and I didn't know what the heck I was you know, taking on here, because I don't know how to cook. I don't know. I mean, I'm absolutely all thumbs, and I just, you know, so it was really an adventure, because we didn't, we had to all do it together. There was no real sort of father figure. It was just all of us fending for ourselves, trying to figure out over the course of the summer where our next meal was coming from. but we made it through, and we had a blast.
So I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of John Prendergast. And my other guest is Michael Maddox, and they've written a book together, Unlikely Brothers, Our Story of Adventure, Loss, and Redemption. And we're going through that story right now. Michael, what was that summer like for you guys?
Oh, my God. Man, that summer was fun. I mean, we was in another place that we, you know, like I say, we was in a place that we didn't really know nobody, but everybody loved us. You know what I'm saying? Everybody loved us. Every last friend John brought us to or whatever, they liked us. You know what I'm saying? And we up in Philly and we having fun that whole summer. We had fun.
That's...
You know, we met new people and new kids. We running around with the new kids and... You know, I mean, it was fun. It really was.
And you, I mean, I'm sensing you also had stability that summer.
Yeah.
One place for the whole summer,
yeah.
Right?
One
home.
Place, yes.
Yeah.
One place for the whole summer. So that was a good thing.
Now, John, I'm curious. Oh, let me tell people, by the way, this is KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum. We're at about the halfway mark. John, so you really, you show up there and you say to your family, you know, by the way, I've got these three kids for the summer. How was your family? And I'm curious where your relationship with you and your dad fits in at this moment.
Yeah, it was crazy because although they lived most of the time in the apartment I had down in Philly, that we'd also go out to the suburbs where my mom and dad lived, and we'd stay over there sometimes. And crazily, you know, I had just literally no communication with my dad. But he, I'm sure Michael can testify to this, was incredible with the kids. I mean, he was such a great sort of grandfather figure. And despite the fact that, you know, he could have just turned his back on it because it involved me, he sort of just overlooked the elephant in the living room, which was our relationship, and just jumped right in head first into the kind of caring of for the kids. And my mom was just really great. You know, she cooked the meals. She, you know, was very loving but very disciplining towards them, so making sure that they were always minding their P's and Q's. So she played a really important role, I think, early on in their lives, just like she had for me and my brother, my biological brother. And so, so I think it was great. Like, they really just jumped in and helped out without a lot of explanation, you know, because I wasn't talking much to family at that point.
And Michael, what did you notice? What was going on between John and his dad?
I never knew. We never paid attention. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, we small, we love, you know what I'm saying, Mrs. P, Mr. P, and John. And Mr. P, I'm talking about we had so much fun with him where we didn't even notice that him and John didn't have a good relationship. You know, I learned about that in the book, you know.
That is wild.
I never seen that.
That
you know
is
what I'm
wild. Yeah. And you and John had never talked about it either.
Never.
That is amazing. Yeah.
And I never knew that it was like that at all, because when we would go up there, you know, Mr. P would put us in that station wagon and we'd be gone. You know what I'm saying? We'd be gone. We had so much fun with Mr. P, and he had a lot of fun with us too.
So you had a granddaddy too.
Yes, he used to have so much fun with us. I mean, for real.
So
you know, we coming up, he'd be so happy.
That is great. That is great. Now, let's take it, I don't know exactly how many years, but there's a point at which you become involved with Africa John. And you, as you said, you'd been focused on domestic policy and homeless and education and so on. And how did your involvement with Africa start?
Well, it was really that thing I was telling about earlier when I saw the pictures of the Ethiopian famine, and I went. I just went.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, well, I mean, to take it from a sudden dawning to actual action, you just did. How long between the time you see the commercial, the time you're in Africa?
Well, at the time, part of the reason why it was longer than I hoped is because I had gotten an injury from playing basketball, so I had a pre-cast. I think I had the cast put on the next day, but I was had the ice on there and I had the ankle up. And it's part of the reason why I didn't get up and change the channel. I think my whole life I would have been a sports writer right now had I not had that injury. But
I can hear that.
I mean, you know, so I just watched this thing and I was like, and it just bowled me over. And so then, you know, I crushed around. I actually had to go to D.C. to go to all the embassies to see which embassy would give me a visa to go to, like, Africa. Like, you can't just go. You got to get a visa and and you know, permission from the country to come in a very formalized way. And the first few countries I tried to go to, I went to their embassies. They didn't give me a visa, so I finally ended up getting one from a country in West Africa called Mali. And it's just one of these things where serendipity or divine intervention, when I was on the plane traveling from Paris to the capital of Mali, a city called Bamako, a guy on the plane from Mali recognized me from the old days playing hoops up at the Georgetown gym, and he was like, "What are you doing?" and just took me under his wing, and it turned out he was a major kind of official in the Malian government's agriculture department. So he, all the issues that I was interested in, you know, food security, why people are hungry, why they starve, like what's going on with all these issues, he was an expert in, and he had he took me under his wing, and we just traveled all over the southern and central part of Mali, and it was just incredible. It was like a crash course.
I was going to say, you get on the plane not sure exactly what you're going to do, and by the time you get off, your path is there.
I had no idea what I was going to do. I mean, in fact, look back on it and think what a crazy idea it was that I could just go to a place and think just by showing up there, I'd get it, I'd understand it and be able to figure, and I didn't have hardly any money. I mean, it was just, I was pretty reckless, but it was, you know, it was driven by this intense desire to understand how this could happen in our world, how people could suffer this greatly when we have so much.
Okay, so I'm going to fast forward a little so we can get through this. But what happens is you get this trip leads to more involvement, and you begin spending how much of your time in Africa?
Yeah, I'd say about half of the year I would spend in Africa, or a little bit more than half, and the rest of the time I'd be back in the U.S. I'd write articles and books and do radio shows and all kinds of things, try on TV and anything I could do to try to raise the alarm about some of the hot spots in Africa and the places where human rights issues and food security issues were most compelling and dire. And that's really, it was the pattern I spent till about 96, and then late 96 is when I got recruited to go into government.
Right. And Michael, what happens, how much less are you seeing John now, and how old are you when this begins to happen?
Let me see. I probably was about 9, John. I was about,
I think you were 9, 10, right through the early part of your teen years, you know, like I was just gone.
Yeah, he was gone, like gone.
So the angel that had come into your life is now disappearing. What happens to you?
Yes. Well, at that time, we used to be so sad when John disappeared, because he was like I say, our angel, where it was like he shielded us and kept us, you know what I'm saying, kept us motivated and as little kids and going, you know. And then when he wouldn't show up, we'd be sad. But let me tell you this, he will always find us. I don't care where we were. And when we would see John, we'd be so happy. But we knew that he was going to be gone again. You know what I'm saying? We'd be so happy, but we knew that John would be gone again. You know what I'm saying? He'd come around, stay around for about 6 months, bam, he gone again. You know what I'm saying?
So you felt like the bond was still there, but
But
for a lot of the time, John wasn't.
Nah, he wasn't.
At what point do you get pulled into the streets and drugs?
Wow. It all happened when we moved to a certain little location, you know, which is a different side of town where we moved to, and he wasn't no longer around, and you know, we start seeing, you know, seeing things we never saw before, which is the drugs, you know, the drug addicts, you know, and start seeing the drug dealers, and you know, they got the fancy clothes and the jewelry, the fancy cars, and you know, we seeing this stuff, and You know, John, he still come around. When you come back, we gone. But at the same token, you still watching these people like, man, this is what I want to do. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. And at this point, are you still in homeless shelters or have you found a home?
No, we found a home at this time.
But you're still poor and these people have something that looks pretty attractive.
Yes. 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 You know what I'm saying? And, you know, the more he wasn't coming around, the more I was getting sucked into the street life.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm saying? The street life was amazing. You know what I'm saying? Because you basically can get anything. You know what I'm saying? The drugs, the women. And, you know, you're seeing all this as a little kid, and you like, which you don't supposed to be like, man, I want to do that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can hear it. Now, at a very young age, you actually do some sales and find out that you're good at this and that you can put some money away very quickly.
Yes, yes, and I was 11 years old.
Wow.
11 years old. So my first drug, you know what I'm saying?
Now, were you also, were you using at that age or just selling?
No, I was just selling at that age. I didn't even like, you know what I'm saying, because I remember the drug dealer told me, don't never get high off your own supply. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I was just, you know, selling. When you think about it, you're a little kid and you see that you can make a couple of $100, you're going to go make that couple of $100.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Now, when you're making that $100, are you bringing some of it home to mom?
Oh, no. She would have whooped my tail.
So in other words, your family is still very poor. And,
yes.
But you're making some real cash, which you have to keep secret.
Yes, for the time being, yeah.
So, now, fast forward so we can get John spending more and more time in Africa. You're attracted to this lifestyle. How deeply did you get into it?
Oh, man, I got deeply into it. Deeply. Where I became the big time drug dealer of the neighborhood. You know what I'm saying?
At what age?
I became a big-time drug dealer of a neighborhood. I was selling big weight when I was 14 years old.
Wow.
And then when I turned 17, that's when the real deal started, where I was making money, where I was making anywhere from $1,500 to $3,500 a day.
Wow.
And I wasn't nothing but 17 years old. Didn't know what to do with all that money. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. You know, it's crazy.
Now, you're making money selling drugs. How close are you to guns and death?
Wow. Too close to guns and death. I had plenty of guns. I had all kinds of guns. You know what I'm saying? I almost got killed. You know, I almost got shot so many times. You know, but, you know, I didn't. You know, I almost did. You know, I almost did. Well, I had things happening to me out there, you know. I mean, but I escaped it, you know. I escaped it.
And you lost, but you lost people close to you.
Oh, man, yes. You know, as we speak, I lost majority of all my friends, you know, that I loved. And, you know, I lost my brother.
Now, how did your brother die?
Well, I had one brother, you know, got shot. I had another brother who committed suicide. And my other brother, he got killed in jail.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and then I just lost my dad. And then I lost a lot of, I mean, when I say, like, friends, you know, I lost a lot of friends. One of my best friends got killed in front of me when I was smaller. I'm 13 years old. I shot right in the head, you know. That was real painful there, too. So I lost a lot of people.
Now, what happens to a young person, and even though you're a hardened drug dealer at 17, you're still a young person, what happens to a young person who sees that much death and loses that many people around them?
Trauma. Trauma, trust me. I mean, I still go through it right now to this day, you know, over there, because, you know, like I say, my friends and then my brothers and, you know, losing that many people that you love, you know, that's a painful situation. I think that's something that, you know, what help heals me is my boys.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They put a smile on my face and my wife. You know what I'm saying? So that helps heal the process a little bit.
Let me see if I get what you're just saying, Michael. That's the voice of Michael Maddox, by the way. I'm talking with Michael and John Prendergast, and John was a big brother to Michael, and they've written a book called Unlikely Brothers, which I highly recommend. You're saying that to this day, the pain haunts you, and it's your children and your wife that get you through it?
Yes, that's what keep me going and happy, you know. That's what keep me going and happy. But I also sit sometimes and just think about, you know, the people that I have lost, you know. It's painful, you know, it really is.
And let me ask you one last question about that period, Michael. Were you afraid that you would go to jail or that you would get killed? What allowed you to, isn't there a great deal of risk in what you were doing?
Yeah, I know it was a great deal of risk at that time. I didn't care, you know, I really didn't. I didn't care at all, you know what I'm saying? Jail, I mean, I really didn't even look at it that way as the jail thing, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I always stayed two steps ahead of the police, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I always stayed two steps ahead of them, you know, even though I had got caught out there, you know, but I stayed two steps ahead of them. And the death, I wasn't really, at that time, caring, because I had a lot of weapons. I kept a weapon on me. I kept guys around me who had weapons on them. So, you know, I mean, at that time, I really didn't care, you know, till the time came, you know?
What made you quit?
What made me quit? I was getting tired. I know my time was running out on the streets, you know. I know my time was running out on the streets, and I just felt it, you know. God gave me too many chances, and you know, I was playing around with it, and it was just time. I knew it was. My body was, you know, my mind was like, well, you either got some choices.
And what age were you then?
Wow, probably about 21.
Okay, so at about 21, you just start realizing you're maybe not going to escape this. You were lucky. You managed to stay alive, but you it's wearing down. And when you quit, was Nikki in your life at that point?
Yes,
she was.
Yes,
what role did she play in your quitting?
Oh man, she played a role. A heck of a role in me quitting, because she basically kept it strong for me. You know, when I first got my real job and I got that little paycheck I had, I'm like, man, you know, I cried, you know, because I got like 430 something on my check, and I'm like, I make this 430 in about 10 minutes, you know. And I called her and I told her, I said, baby, man, I got 430 something on my check. She's like, what are you mad for? She's like, it's going to be all right. You got to learn how to adapt yourself to working now. You know what I'm saying? And that I did. You know, she never put me down, you know, or nothing. But she was one of the ones that was so happy that I got up off the streets.
Yeah. And were you ever tempted to fall back in?
Trust me, I was tempted so many times. Because I had friends.
That's
you know
right.
What I'm saying? I had friends that I could have went to front me 3-4 kilos, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm,
and I'm like out there on the street, you know what I'm saying? But I just didn't have it in me no more. It wasn't in me no more. I'm telling you, the hustling was not in me. I went from this cold-hearted hustler, gun-toting person, where I didn't even have it in me no more. I just knew my time was running out, and if I get back out there, it was going to happen. I was going to go to jail, I was going to die, or I was going to stay alive, and I wanted to stay alive.
And
I knew what was going to happen.
How early did you have children?
I had little Mike. Little Mike is 14. You know, but we do got an oldest son. That's my, you know, stepson. But, you know, I always say my son because I've been with my wife ever since he was like a couple of months. So
sure.
That's my son, too. But I had my first original son when I was in my 20s.
Okay.
He's 14. So, like, about 15 years ago, probably about the same age, 21.
Okay. About the same age that John big brothered you.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I had my first child, I was still doing stuff, still, you know what I'm saying, doing this and doing that. But it all, you know, started slowing down. Then we had another son, you know what I'm saying? That's when, like, everything really started happening. Like, you know, police was on me. They were ready to get me. And, you know, just a lot of things. And I had a choice. I looked at the boys we had. I said, I love them too much to go to jail or be dead. Because them the ones that's going to suffer. You know, they going to suffer the most if I'm in jail or dead. You know what I'm saying?
I got it, Michael. Okay. It turns out we've got about 5 minutes left. I'm sorry, but this has been so fabulous in terms of what you guys are sharing with me. John,
I'm ready.
You fall out of Michael's life during this period we've just been talking about. One thing I read in your book is that you refused to believe it was happening. Is that right?
You know, I think it was a little self-serving because I was so overwhelmed by the work that I was doing in Africa, and I was coming back, and when I'd come back, I'd see Michael, I'd see the family, Michael's mom was telling me that there were problems. Michael was saying, no, none of it's true. And I just didn't want to believe it. And so I turned the other way, offered a hand just as a friend, but not the kind of intrusive friend sometimes people need to shape up. So I failed him on that score. I in fact, abandoned him at a deeper level. Because I just was too into my sort of new life, new world, and I feel, you know, it was one of the things that I regret more than anything for over the last 20 years was how I wasn't there for Michael when he needed someone the most.
But you say that when you started out this book or this project that you thought, oh, you know, this is going to be Michael's story of what a tough life he had, and that you're going to be, you know, you're going to be the you know, you're the one with the easy one and so on. And it turns out that in your own life, you battled major depression, et cetera, et cetera. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I think having grown up in a somewhat abusive situation and then marching off to Africa into war zones, you know, as early as I could in my early 20s, you know, went from frying pan to the fire in terms of trauma and never dealt with any of it. And it accumulated, you know, and I was walking around carrying a 10-ton weight in the pit of my stomach and didn't know why and thought it was normal. And deeply depressed. And so over time, over the last 5 years, you know, working through issues, counseling and going back into my own past for the purpose of this book, even writing this book and all that. I mean, really, I finally faced a lot of the things that I had never faced before about my own life and about the things that I've experienced. And began to address some of those, you know, and allowed to see a lot of new light emerge that otherwise was fairly dark for many years.
And, John, you have recently married, correct?
That is right.
And you, I think, from when I saw you speak at the Hammer, I sort of got the sense you are, like, looking at Michael and saying, maybe I could be a dad. How much did working on this book and reconnecting with Michael in such an intense way feed you?
Yep, I think it was crucially important that Michael's part of it. You know, again, the whole idea of, you know, the conventional story being that the older guy comes and helps the younger guy and somehow changes his life, and then rarely do we get the postscript where the younger guy comes back in the older guy's life. Me and you know, when I needed somebody I needed to see that something was possible for me too, because, you know, often when you experience trauma early on, you don't feel a sense of entitlement, you don't feel like you deserve anything good. And so the idea that I could see Michael with being a caring husband and a caring father, happy, you know, and they helped me to believe that I could one day have that as well. As strange as that sounds, I didn't believe it for many, many years that I deserved that. And so now I've, you know, finally found the right person, and we got married just 6 months ago. And looking at the absolutely planning for the possibility of having my own kids. Not as many as Michael, but
yeah, Michael's already got another one on the way. I'll tell you what, we have to bring this conversation to a close. We're recording it prior to Christmas, but to the listeners, I hope that this was a good gift to you on your Christmas Day. The book is Unlikely Brothers, and you can learn more about both John's humanitarian work and the book at enoughproject.org, enoughproject.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do that at my site, aworldthatjustmightwork.com, or terrencemcnally.net, or at iTunes. And you can sign up on my site or by emailing me, T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com, to get a weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk.
Thank you, Terrence.
You're welcome.
Listen, you guys have great holidays.
Okay, you too.
Okay.
You
too. Okay.
Yeah, great time. Thanks. Good talking to you.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, you guys.